Well, like thought will is very fast, but feeling or like emotion lingers, but your attitude towards it is like embracing it and observing it. Rather, and if it disappears, that's fine. But if you and to know that, to recognize its absence. Not trying to hang on to it, but just observe the impermanence of say thought and emotion. Like thought will trigger off emotion, or emotional state of mood can also trigger off thinking. You know, so you find when you're in a certain mood, then certain thoughts will arise. Right. Well, then, but you've still got the emotion, which or the feeling, you know, like you can feel, like in your body, you can feel certain tensions or sensations, or just in the mood, as you're aware of, say, the mood of the present. So it's like feeling confused or doubtful or whatever, like this. Because like a mood, you know, like lingering, lingering quality. And as you don't think about it and analyze it, then the mood is just pure. It's purely what it is, and so you're allowing it to be that way. Then it'll cease quite naturally. Then you're aware of its absence. So that you're actually learning how to, say, connect mindfully to from a particular condition that you're experiencing to its absence, and then you're establishing this awareness, which is like what the constant factor in all experience when we're in that state of pure attention and we rest and relax into that state of pure awareness, then we can be aware of the particular conditions that we happen to be experiencing in the present. So we can go, you know, from maybe an emotional state to a feeling of physical pain or pleasure or whatever. I mean, your mind is in a receptive state and in embracing the present. So your relationship to it is one of observing rather than of judging, picking and choosing. It's more just observing, non-judgmental. Right. You have to judge for yourself. Like some things, like oftentimes we want to get rid of something, so but the attitude isn't like being aware of it doesn't mean we're trying to get rid of it. We're accepting it, even if it stays forever. That's more the attitude. Or once you can really see it and you accept, then you can let go or change to something else. It's not that you have to stay with it, but it's changing your relationship to experience from just reactivity to using it for, you know, to learn from. Like being an observer is non-judgmental. So, I mean, it's easy, you know, for us to, there's always, you know, to say, you know, to make some kind of judgment about what we're feeling or thinking. And, you know, this is good or bad or whatever. And it might, you know, it might be good or bad, not to deny that, but that's not our refuge is in judging, but in being aware. So it's more like embracing acceptance rather than the other, which is the judging faculty that we can use, you know, so when it's appropriate. But if we're attached to it, then it tends to we tend to just become very critical and obsessed with, you know, thinking in terms of something's right, something's wrong, something's good and bad. Then that function of the mind tends to divide, you know, create division in the mind. So we experience life always in terms of threat and division, or this against that. Where with mindfulness, it's embracing those opposites, so that even sometimes the relationship is one of patient acceptance, non-judgment, and it's not stupid. So it's not like if something's bad, you're not aware of it as being that way, but you're not judging it. You see, that's the way it is. But you're seeing in terms of say, impermanence, non-self. Yes. Right, well, like any explanation it's just more or less we have to figure these things out as we go along. And what I say is just for is kind of maybe simplification of the process. But it gives a general feeling of how to deal with, especially with negative mental states, which we oftentimes, you know, either we become obsessed with them, or we're trying to resist or deny them. Well, like tranquility, samatha meditation is like a exercise. It's, you know, it's like a mental exercise, because you are concentrating the mind, focusing it, sustaining. It's like sharpening the sword. Or it's like making a candle. You and then vipassana is more like lighting the candle so you can see. So vipassana is like insight. And then you end up with a candle, but you don't light it. Then you might have a nice candle, but you can't see with just the candle until you light it. So if you're trying to do vipassana without any samadhi, then it's like lighting matches. You know, you light one, and then but you can't get sustain. You can't sustain the light because it's not. You know, to burn your fingers every time. But if you don't need to spend your time making a huge candle either. This is where you can just see them as mutually supportive, rather than as this and then that. Like I found. If you have to form too many opinions about it, then people get stuck with those opinions. That's why it's more or less like you find out what works. You know, like sometimes you can tell just in the state of mind you're in what you should. What is useful, either concentrating your mind on, say, the breath, or just reflecting on the way it is, so that you can, sometimes if I find a lot of emotional turmoil and kind of agitation, restlessness, then I find in doing samatha it's too refined. A practice for that. You know, you're trying to force all this kind of stuff into this narrow way. So then I just practice more or less awareness of the feeling of agitation. And as I do that, then that feeling starts. It starts ceasing. Or if I'm trying to conquer that feeling through concentrating my mind on an object, I usually you give up in despair. At least I do. So when you start doing formal meditation, just what kind of, where are you at this time? You know. So then you can see which would be beneficial. There's different, like body sweeping, learning to relax the body. So you feel, you know, if you've got a lot of body tensions and you find a lot of pain and stress and you're kind of controlling and making your body kind of, you know, holding it and causing it tenseness, then it's rather than doing samatha practice on the breath, better to do more awareness of the body, of bodily sensation, like body sweeping, because that will relax the bodily, you know, and you feel it, the sense of tension and relaxing, because the state of mindfulness, and that is more through relaxing rather than through willfully doing something. Because, like, I remember start meditation, I was more, you know, the attitude, say, when I first started was very willful, you know, like, that's how I operated in life, was through willing things to happen. And so I could, you know, do certain amount of, get a certain amount of something out of just willing myself to do something, but in the long run, you couldn't sustain it that way, and also... One created too much tension just through forcing and imposing one's will onto the body, onto the mind. So then it changed from just willfulness to more mindfulness and learning to how to relax how to bring ease into the mind, into the body, in the present. Yeah.
My life, if I would say that this talk yesterday was a method of having a biofeedback of experience in the mental system and consciousness.
Right. And biofeedback, I think, works in the same principle. Like as you, like if, with your body, as you concentrate on it, you know, you bring it into your consciousness, then it will, the body will relax. But if you're trying to make your body relax, as an act of will, it gets more tense. Right. Yeah. Next Sunday, Ajahn Veerdhamma will give the talk. Since I'm going to Italy on Tuesday, to our Bihara there, and be there for a week. So this is my last summer talk. When I come back from Italy, then I'll be giving a retreat. Any more questions? Well, certainly, I think it helps. unless you're in a, like I found, like I was quite self-motivated, so I could kind of, you know, kind of do things on my own. But actually, over the years, I found living with like somebody like Ajahn Chah very helpful because you're actually, you know, he helps to reflect your own kind of limitations. Which oftentimes, if you're operating too much on your own, you can't see on your own. And in community life, you, like in monastic community, you find these sort of continuous kind of reflection on, you know, having to, you know, live with different people who bring up different emotions. Like here, this is quite a fairly big community, Amaravati. And you've got nuns, monks, and lay people all living here. So it has, you know, quite, you've got a lot of impact on you. If you're living by yourself, it's very different. Or if you're just a very small community of monks that you might have affinities with, well, then usually, you know, then maybe you get some monk come in who's you know, the sore thumb, and that has its effect. And then living with nuns, in the same monastery. That has different effects. So the mindfulness is, you might have preferences for one place over another, but the point isn't so much to follow your preferences, but to learn from what you're experiencing. So, like, I found living here very helpful. Because I would prefer on a personal level, maybe small community where you don't have too many things rubbing up against you. But in terms of the value that I learned from this community, probably much more than if I had it more one that I would prefer. Yes? Well, then that would be with mindfulness. You're like with self-will, and how I define that is you're trying to get rid of it or deny it or whatever. But thy will, and you're more willing to let it be what it is, and your relationship to it changes from rather than how can I get rid of it? To this is opportunity to learn how to accept this and learn from it. Whatever happens, then your relationship to it is one more. You're prepared to learn from it, because we learn from those things. We learn from pain, from limitation, from frustration. They're not like, those aren't the obstructions to enlightenment, but it's the obstruction is always the willful act out of ignorance. And the clinging and attachment out of ignorance. I mean, you can live perfectly healthy, with no physical problems and still be, create endless suffering around all kinds of things, the possibilities of worrying about getting a disease or whatnot. But actually, with people with like terminal illnesses or degenerative diseases, once they change their attitude, then they even feel gratitude for it. Seeing it as something ruining their lives, they see it as something that awakens them to life. Both. like here, and you have certain monks certainly, willing to let you know what and a monastic rule in Vinaya, you've got this admonishment. You always, the idea is to make yourself open to admonishment so that this is where you do get feedback, and it's important because you can't see how you're affecting things till somebody tells you. So that's where maybe your intentions are quite good, but what you're actually doing is having harmful effects. You don't realize it until somebody tells you. And that's very useful. Because you know you start out, you don't like what is it? Some Zen story about the most frightening monk in the monastery is the new one that has the stick, you know, because he doesn't have the experience on how to use it. They tend to, you get into kind of controlling through discipline. And then, you know, having been in the military too, I found my first way of trying to run a monastery is more like, you know, trying to make everybody march in step, like boot camp. Yeah, that was the precedent I had for experience. But then you learn, you know, from that. You don't, you know, your tendency to. It's interesting, you know, how we revert to situations in our lifetime. Like when I was teaching English in this Chinese school in Borneo, they were children maybe about 9 years old, Chinese children, and I was teaching English to them, and then and I could speak. We'd been trained in kind of Malay language, but it was a Mandarin medium school. And I'd already studied some Mandarin, so I could say a few things. But generally, I felt I'd never taught children like that young before, and then we didn't have, you know, I felt very ill at ease having this being the first time trying to teach in this Chinese school these children that I didn't have a common language that you could fluently use, and so then I noticed. That I was the first few weeks, you know, the way I tend to react to these children was surprising me. You know, I started seeing that what I was actually doing was acting like the school teachers I had when I was that age. And they were, you know, like they were in my generation that. School teachers were usually spinsters, and they and I remember them being quite, you know, nagging and kind of browbeating you. So I tended to, and you know, I had no intention of doing that, but I after studying, you know, understanding them, how the mind works, how you unconsciously kind of reverted back to a similar experience when maybe I was that age, because I didn't know. And how to deal with it, yeah, for what it was. And so, you know, if you do find yourself doing things and reacting in strange ways, you know, it's not intentional, but we tend to use precedence of something in our own lives. Sorry about that. Some of my best friends have spinsters. Like I found great help to contemplate this, like the future as being, you know, anticipation, like anticipating things, you know, or the state of mind where we start maybe this sort of speculating possibilities of success or failure in the future, or it's always guessing or speculating or fantasizing or anticipating or dreading, you know, thinking this, you know, something terrible will happen, or worry. So just to get to know these mental states, or states we create around the unknown or the possibilities in the future. And so it's really getting to know that we're creating these mental states, rather than we're just than we're believing in them. And then this is our creation. So the future, then I can worry, I can dread, I can plan, I can speculate, fantasize. But these are, and that's not that even these things are wrong in themselves, but it's when we're caught into that, so that our relationship is always, you know, thinking about the future, and planning or worrying or dreading the future. Because the liberating path is through being in the present. So it helps you to get the future into perspective as something, you know, not put so much, not believe in it so much, not give it so much importance, what happens in the future. Because like when you're young especially, we put a lot of importance on future. When I get my education, when I have my book published, when I have my raise and all this, you know, then we're expecting, you know, or anticipating something or dreading something. But in meditation, like being with the breath, with the body, with the mood, and that you're learning to relax into the present, so your attitude is one of receptiveness and relaxed awareness in the present, which you'll find is something, you know, that is sustainable. You know, it's not just just something that as you begin to trust yourself and have confidence that you can do this, then you realize it's something you can. It's a real refuge, rather than thinking that in the future you've got to find this ideal place that maybe you can control things and feel safe in. You're more willing to, you know, you're realizing that you know, even then if all your energy has been put into trying to get something in the future, even if you can buy the perfect place, the perfect house, and exactly the situation, conditions there that you've dreamed of, you'll still be stuck with the same mental state, planning for the future, because that's your habit. So, like even with like diseases or degenerative diseases, and that, you know, you can dread about, you know, you can play on the worst possible scenario of the future and dread it, or you can learn how to relax with this and be more accepting and patient and wise with it. So then, in the future, whatever happens, you have that way of relating to it, rather than just caught in always worrying about it. So even if it does, you know, even if it gets worse and worse, your relationship to it is one of is always right, rather than anxious, worried, blaming, resentful. Because like healthy people can make It can make our lives really miserable, worrying about possible misfortunes in the future. Yes. Let's see, biggest worry. I like taking on responsibilities. Now, being a teacher or an abbot, and these things are very, you know, I've been brought up to give a lot of importance to the idea of being responsible for what I'm doing. So then you're put in positions like I have been here in England, where you're looked up to as teacher, as an administrator, as an abbot, spiritual advisor, and all kinds of elevated kind of positions that have tremendous responsibilities attached to them. So then that, being a preceptor, where I ordain people, and then I'm taking on, and we have this.